The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the January 8, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. First, I'll read two essays from the Talk of the Town section, followed by a longer piece in the Critic at Large section. So let's get started. The first essay is in the comments section of the Talk of the Town entitled Words of the Year by Louis Menand. If language, as Emerson said, is fossil poetry, then youthquake seems like a plastic bone. Youthquake is the verbal concoction recently declared Word of the year being 2017, by the experts at Oxford Dictionaries. They define it as a, quote, significant cultural, political, or social change arising from the actions or influence of young people, end quote. The actions and the influence of young people not being unusually notable or effectual during the past year, you might wonder whether the Oxonians are confusing 2017 with 1967. Actually, youthquake dates from 1965, when it was coined by the fashion industry. But Oxford says that the incidence of youthquake spiked around the time of the British elections last June, when the Conservative Party did worse than expected and a surge of votes for Labour was attributed to high turnout among younger voters. Well, given that Labour did not win a majority, and Brexit remains in progress under the auspices of a Conservative Prime Minister, it's a little hard to know what the quake part was. Youthquake has also been criticized in Britain as the kind of word that someone sitting at a desk, such as a headline writer, might come up with, a word that no one would use in speech. People prefer to have their neologisms boil up unbidden from the global electronic soup, like, for instance, quote, milkshake duck, end quote. One of the runners-up to youthquake. You can Google that one, and it is a word, or is it a meme? Nevertheless, we are assumed that youthquake is a word on the move. Other usage professionals have chosen their own Words of the Year 2017 edition, and the honorees have a similarly wonky character. Populism in the Cambridge Dictionary, feminism for Merriam-Webster's, and complicit in dictionary.com. According to Merriam-Webster's, quote, feminism was the most searched for word in its online dictionary, up 70% from 2016. But who in 2017 needed to be told what feminism means? Upon searching, these people would have learned from Merriam-Webster's that the definition of feminism is, quote, the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes, end quote. Some number of them were probably relieved to learn that it's still just a theory. On the whole, 2017 was not a great year for the English language. Reality is running ahead of our vocabulary. For one thing, no good terms have emerged to describe the current state of political affairs. What is the ideology of this administration? It is not social conservatism or neoliberalism, and it's certainly not populism, though it may be faux populism. Nationalism seems to be the default term, but that does not capture the freebooting and bullying behavior of everyday political life. Normal terms do not apply. We are living in a down-is-up, war-is-peace world. It may be that, in the language of politics, a few words are ready to be cycled out. Some of these words are words that ended up on the losing side. It's a good bet that Americans will not be hearing diversity or together much in the next presidential election. In the lexicon of commentary, some terms have suffered serious semantic erosion and could be dropped. Normalization once meant making the deviant conform to the ordinary, but it now means the opposite, accepting the deviant as the new ordinary. Pivot used to mean turning one's attention to, as in, quote, Obama's pivot to China. It now means something like more like faking it for political effect, as in, my God, Trump is not pivoting. It turned out he didn't because he couldn't. Now, it would be nice to see if we can live without double down, which now seems to mean refuse to acknowledge the obvious. And breaking news, isn't that a redundancy? Arguably, the word of the year is not a word at all. It's an alphanumeric character, hashtag. The president speaks in hashtag, but so do the president's opponents, and so does, for example, the hashtag MeToo movement. Like most major shifts in communicative modes, hashtag democratizes while freaking out traditionalists, who worry, not wrongly, about the loss of ambiguity and complexity. But look, something is being said and it's being read. With all the damage that's being done to the social fabric, in matters ranging from race relations to income inequality, to name just two areas where the national leadership seems not only determined to make things worse, but weirdly excited about it, fretting over the state of the language seems like an indulgence. Fossil poetry or not, words are tools, and what matters is the job that they are being made to do. Still, language is a commons. It's a resource that we share, and the resource is impoverished when words are redefined, weaponized, or otherwise co-opted and bent out of shape. A good candidate for Word of the Year in this category is fake. Fake once meant counterfeit or inauthentic, like a fake Picasso or a fake birth certificate. It is now used to mean, quote, I deny your reality, end quote. Hoax is used with the same intention. Alternative facts, another phrase associated with reality denial, seems to have been mocked out of existence. Many Americans were shocked to hear their beliefs characterized as, quote, fake science or fake news. Those Americans thought that they understood what counts as evidence, what counts as reason, what counts as an argument. Suddenly, the rules change. In national politics, you no longer need evidence or reason. You no longer need to make an argument. You need only to assert. And if your assertion is questioned, you need only to repeat it. Fake and hoax are the abracadabras of the Trump world. Words recited to make inconvenient facts disappear. In most of life after nursery school, abracadabra doesn't work because it stops fooling other people. For grown-ups, as a rule, saying something doesn't make it so. This is not true of presidents, however, grown-up or not. Presidents are legally empowered to make what comes out of their mouths a reality for other people. This president has realized that he can say literally anything, and someone will pop up to explain it or explain it away. When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, Humpty Dumpty says to Alice. How can you make a word mean so many different things? Alice asks. The question, Humpty Dumpty replies, is which is to be master. That's all. George Orwell said the same thing, meaning at bottom is about power. Truth, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. once said, is, quote, the majority vote of the nation that could lick all others, end quote. A disagreeable thought, but not an inappropriate one in 2017. Later on, of course, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, something to look forward to in 2018. Happy New Year. Next, from the talk of the town, in the ink section, we have an essay by Rand Coopers called Hot Type. One recent afternoon, Walter Minton, the 94-year-old former president of G.P. Putnam's Sons, sat in the study of his house in Saddle River, New Jersey, and reminisced about the controversial novels he championed in his youth and the trials of getting them into print. Minton was dressed in slacks and a cardigan, with a thinning head of white hair. He still wears the trim, boxy beard that he adopted mid-career. He was 31 when he took over Putnam's in 1955, and the shelves of his living room offer a higgly-piggly tour of his route through 20th century publishing, from Jean Le Carré to Mario Puzo to Scott Turow. Of all his writers, Minton said, the most difficult was Norman Mailer. Mailer was a quite ordinary writer type until he got angry, Minton said. Then he was a different kind of fish. Minton had admired Mailer's debut novel, The Naked and the Dead, and when he heard that the novelist had a manuscript, The Deer Park, that no publisher would touch because of a passage involving oral sex, he pursued it. Bennett Cerf, a co-founder of Random House, phoned to dissuade him. Cerf said, "Walter, I know you're young, but if you publish this book, you'll bring down the great veil of censorship." Minton laughed. "We published it and ran ads. The book, six publishers refused to bring you." Mailer and Minton, Second World War veterans a year apart in age, shared a pugnacious streak. "Check this out," Minton said, pulling down a copy of The Deer Park, inscribed by its authors. Quote, "To Ernest Hemingway," it read, "I am deeply curious to know what you think of this. But if you do not answer, or if you answer with the kind of crap you use to answer unprofessional writers, sycophants, brown noses, etc., then F you, and I will never attempt to communicate with you again." He shook his head. "Mailer asked me to get this to Hemingway. I told him I mailed it to Cuba, and it came back, addressee unknown." Mailer, who referred to Minton as very bold, once called him the only publisher I ever met who would make a good general. Emboldened by The Deer Park, Minton followed with a bigger coup, Lolita. A long list of American publishers too timid to issue the book had forced Vladimir Nabokov, at the time a little-known emigre writer, to turn to Maurice Gerodias, whose Paris-based Olympia Press churned out erotic potboilers. Minton got hold of an excerpt of the novel via the unlikely agency of an exotic dancer named Rosemary Ridgewell, in whose living room he once fell asleep after a night on the town. "I awoke in the middle of the night, and there was this story on the table, and I started reading it. By morning, I knew I had to publish it." Visits to Paris ensued to deal with the mercurial Gerodias, as he did a flight to Cornell during a storm to woo Nabokov. Minton saw the novel as a marketer's dream. It had a reputation of being very sexy, though it really wasn't, and a lot of publishers who wouldn't bring it to you because it was too, quote, dirty. To me, that was an opportunity. Sure enough, when Putnam's released Lolita in August of 1958, Orville Prescott in the Times called it, quote, repulsive, highbrow pornography, end quote. And the novel zoomed to the top of the bestseller list. After Lolita, Minton poached Gerodias' list for Terry Southern and Mason Hoffenberg's bawdy comedy, Candy, and also published Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, better known as Fanny Hill, John Cleland's 1749 chronicle of erotic adventure. When Putnam's published Fanny Hill in 1963, New York City officials suppressed the book for obscenity. The publisher was eventually vindicated by the Supreme Court. Mailer, in a letter affectionately addressed Minton as a litigious prick, "I honestly didn't see anything wrong with those books," Minton said. "None of them." In 1975, Putnam's was acquired by MCA and Minton was forced out. Whereupon, at 55, he became a law student at Columbia. He talked about what killed the publishing industry he had known: the rise of agents, the influence of Hollywood. Traditionally, publishers and editors talked to their authors, he said. When the agents came along, that became much rarer. Now, you went to lunch with them. Nabokov referred to Minton's house, a 1960 colonial with tall white columns, as the house Lolita built. Minton looked out of his study window and watched a family of four deer that had made its way into the backyard. See that buck? He sends the does out first. He won't stick his neck out. He paused. You can learn a lot from watching those deer. Okay, next, from the A Critic at Large section, we have an essay titled Been There, The Presidential Election of 1968 by Louis Menand. Almost 50 years ago, on March 31, 1968, Lyndon Johnson stunned everyone by announcing that he would not run for a second term as president. Johnson had gone on television at 9 o'clock that evening to address the nation on the war in Vietnam. It was not going well. In the past 3 years, the United States had dropped more tons of bombs on Vietnam than were dropped by all the belligerents combined in the Second World War. 20,000 Americans had died there, 4,000 in the previous 2 months alone, following a surprise attack known as the Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces. Enemy losses were much higher, but that only made the war seem more horrific and out of control. I was at home, sitting in the basement where we kept our television set, listening to Johnson's speech with my father. He was standing with his back to the screen so that he would not have to look at Johnson. He was protesting Johnson's policy on Vietnam. The only person present in the basement to appreciate the symbolism was me. My father had already registered his opposition in a more substantive way. He had been working in Washington, D.C. for one of Johnson's anti-poverty programs, but he had resigned because he felt he couldn't work for an administration that was propping up autocratic regimes in Saigon and napalming the Vietnamese. So, we had moved back to Massachusetts, where he took a lesser job with, I assume, a lower salary. Now, in his address, Johnson announced a reduction of American airstrikes and said that he would seek a negotiated settlement. But he also said that he was sending more troops. Then he said, quote, I've concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. My father perked up. He did not, however, turn around. Accordingly, Johnson went on, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president. He's not running! My father shouted to my mother, who was upstairs. She had refused even to listen to Johnson. That's the kind of house I grew up in. He's not running! For anti-war liberals like my parents, who had marched in Washington the previous October in a giant demonstration organized by a group known as the MOB, the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, Johnson was a monster who had betrayed liberalism, and the knight who slayed him was Eugene McCarthy. McCarthy was the senior senator from Minnesota, a liberal anti-communist whose roots, like my parents, were in New Deal politics. Unlike my parents, McCarthy had a spiritual side. As a young man, he had entered a monastery under the name Brother Conan, but was kicked out for the sin of intellectual pride. McCarthy had always been, or had a bit of, contemptus mundi about him. Turning your back to the television set was the kind of gesture he would have understood. In the beginning, McCarthy was a single-issue candidate. He was a dove. He ran against continued American military intervention in Vietnam, but he was also offended by the administration's insistence that its war powers were absolute and by its increasingly transparent lies about the progress of the war. He had come to see the administration as a danger to democracy. He was an enemy of what used to be called, quote, the imperial presidency. As unpopular as Johnson was in 1968 with Democrats like my parents, he was a man politicians thought twice before crossing. He had won the 1964 presidential election against Barry Goldwater with the highest percentage of the popular vote in American history, and he knew how to squeeze his opponents. Even Democrats in Congress who knew that Johnson was driving the country off a cliff were loath to break with him publicly. And by the end of 1967, when 485,000 Americans were stationed in Vietnam, the folly of intervention had become plain. But McCarthy broke with him. In November 1967, he announced that he was entering the Democratic presidential primaries. He was running against a sitting president of his own party. Many people thought that he had committed Harry Caray, a noble act possibly, but politically insane. The New Hampshire primary, held on March 12, 1968, made those people think again. It wasn't because McCarthy did especially well. Johnson's name was not even on the Democratic ballot, but he won easily as a write-in candidate with 49% of the Democratic vote. McCarthy got 42%, despite the fact that his name was the only name on the ballot, and even though he had 5,000 New Hampshire students and 2,000 out-of-state volunteers canvassing the state for him. McCarthy received about 22,000 Democratic votes, roughly 3 votes for every campaign worker. Well, in national politics, 22,000 was not an intimidating number of votes. 22,000 people would not even fill half of Yankee Stadium, and New Hampshire was not a state that Democrats needed to carry. In the previous 5 presidential elections, it had voted Republican 4 times. The exception was the Johnson landslide in 1964. The winner of the Republican primary, Richard Nixon, got 84,000 votes, 30,000 more than Johnson and McCarthy combined. But blood was in the water, and 4 days later, on March 16th, Robert F. Kennedy, the junior senator from New York, declared his candidacy. If Kennedy hadn't entered the race, Johnson could have fended off McCarthy. In 1968, the primaries played a minor role in the delegate selection process. 36 states did not even hold them. The parties controlled the process. The man who eventually won the Democratic nomination, Herbert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, did not enter a single primary. Robert Kennedy is one of the great what-ifs of American political history. In 1968, he was just 43 years old. He had the most glamorous name in politics. He wore the mantle of martyrdom, and he had transformed himself from a calculating infighter. He had managed his brother's presidential campaign in 1960 and served as attorney general after the election, into a kind of existential messiah. At the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, he had received a 22-minute standing ovation just by appearing at the lectern. There was a rawness in Kennedy's face and voice that seemed to match the national mood. He was the personification of the country's pain over its fallen leader. And he had the ability to reflect back whatever voters projected onto him. He seemed to combine youth with experience, intellect with heart, street sense with vision. He was a hero to Chicano grape pickers, to inner-city African-Americans, to union workers. He was a man of the times, when the times they were a-changin'. Kennedy had haters. Having haters is part of the job of being a messiah, but he was salvific. He could rouse audiences to a frenzy, and he could make hardened politicos weep. People thought that he could go to the convention and steal the nomination from Johnson. People thought that he could beat Nixon. Johnson was not salvific. Waist deep in the big muddy, and the big fool says to push on, I heard Pete Singer sing in Washington in 1967. It's a song about a platoon in the Second World War, but everyone knew who the big fool was. The line was electric. Pete was a sing-along performer, and the liberal audience, who else would be at a Pete Seeger concert, roared it out. It was as though they had forgotten that Johnson had pushed through two major pieces of civil rights legislation. The Civil Rights Act of 64, which made discrimination by race or religion or sex illegal, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which guaranteed the franchise to African Americans in the formerly segregated South. Those were the greatest legal advances in race relations since the Civil War amendments. But by 1968, Vietnam had eclipsed them. Johnson had no experience in foreign policy. Much as Harry Truman had done in 1947 and 1948, he allowed the generals and the policy hawks to convince him of a central fallacy of Cold War thinking, that America's standing was at stake in every regime change around the world. He did not want to be the president who lost Southeast Asia to communism. By 1968, Johnson's Great Society programs, legislation on education, health care, urban renewal, and transportation, whose scope rivaled that of the New Deal, were all dying because of the cost of the war, and he had imposed a 10% income surtax, a dependable way to become unpopular with just about everybody. Inflation, which had been low for most of the post-war era, had reached 4%. It went much higher. The country was on the brink of an economic retrenchment that took 15 years to work through. The message of New Hampshire, therefore, was not that McCarthy was the answer to the nation's troubles. It was that Johnson was the face of what many voters wanted to get away from. New Hampshire did not make McCarthy seem electable so much as it made Johnson seem beatable. That was the message that Kennedy had been waiting to hear, and he wasted little time jumping into the race. He was accused, rightly, of opportunism. Although Johnson had served as John F. Kennedy's vice president, there was no love lost between him and the Kennedys. He was not cut out for a part in Camelot. Colonel Cornpone, Jackie Kennedy used to call him. At the first cabinet meeting after JFK was assassinated, Robert arrived late, and everyone in the room rose as a sign of respect, except for Johnson. 5 years later, Johnson was losing one war overseas. He could not engage on a second front at home. So on March 31st, 2 weeks after Kennedy entered the race, Johnson made my father briefly a happy man. After March 31st, the primaries became a mano a mano between Kennedy and McCarthy. As a campaigner, Kennedy was hot and McCarthy was cool. But McCarthy did not suffer from the contrast, at least among white liberals. He had established his own aura, the aura of the samurai, unswerving and ascetic. On May 28th, he defeated Kennedy in the Oregon primary. It was the first time in 27 consecutive races that any Kennedy had lost an election. On June 5th, Kennedy rebounded and won the big one, California. Minutes after declaring victory, he was shot in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. He died the next day, along with the seeds of whatever future America he carried with him. All the anti-war fury in the Democratic Party could now focus its hopes on McCarthy. I went with my family to see him on July 25th at an enormous rally at Fenway Park in Boston. McCarthy's wife, Abigail, who was closely involved in the campaign, defined McCarthy's constituency as, quote, academia united with the mobile society of scientists, educators, technologists, and the new post-World War II college class, end quote. If that was your base in 1968, Fenway Park was the ideal place to address it. Almost 40,000 people were jammed into a stadium whose official capacity is under 38,000. 5,000 more listened outside. McCarthy was introduced by Leonard Bernstein, a man practiced in podium histrionics. I can still hear him cueing McCarthy's entrance. "Even now, entering from the center field bleachers..." A door opened under the stands, and McCarthy walked across the field to a speaker's platform at second base. McCarthy had adopted the rhetoric of revolution. It was to be a revolution of reason and common sense, of course. McCarthy was a Midwesterner and a Catholic. He loathed the yippies and the student radicals. His student volunteers were encouraged to, quote, to go, quote, clean for Gene, end quote. But the language of revolution was what you used to mobilize anti-war liberals in 1968. So McCarthy spoke at Fenway about the power of the people and called his campaign a kind of uprising. McCarthy had a wry and slightly professorial tone. "Almost everything that the church tried to give up at the Vatican Council has been picked up by the Defense Department," he said at one point. I don't think that line would have meant much in Cleveland, but it received knowing chortles and applause in Boston. He got his loudest and most sustained reaction when he mentioned the convention, then 1 month away in Chicago. "Any visit to Chicago is always beset with some uncertainties, some dangers," he said. Applause indicating that understatement was always appreciated. "But I think we shall succeed there." He said it in the most nonchalant tone of voice imaginable, but the cheers went on and on. Those were the cheers of desperation, tribute to a valiant effort doomed to come up short. Everyone at Fenway knew that McCarthy did not have the delegates. He would have to inspire a stampede at the convention to rip the nomination from Humphrey, who stood to inherit Johnson's delegates. In the minds of everyone who was old enough, there probably flickered the memory of a speech that McCarthy had delivered at the 1960 Democratic Convention, putting Adlai Stevenson's name in nomination. "Do not lead this prophet without honor in his own party," McCarthy had said, setting off a floor demonstration that threatened to steal the convention from JFK. But lightning was not likely to strike twice, and in 1960, Kennedy won on the first ballot anyway. We watched every minute of the 1968 convention in our basement, and there were some very late nights. What everyone remembers are the attacks by the police and the National Guardsmen on demonstrators in the streets outside. In fact, the networks did not devote much time to covering those. Out of 38 hours of convention coverage, CBS devoted 32 minutes to the demonstrators. NBC devoted 14 minutes out of 19 hours of coverage. But the scene inside the hall, the Chicago Amphitheater on the south side near the stockyards, was tumultuous enough. The CBS reporters Dan Rather and Mike Wallace were roughed up by a security personnel. After a vote on an anti-war platform plank failed, members of the New York delegation joined arms and sang, "We Shall Overcome." When Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut was giving a speech, the mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, shouted at him, quote, "F you, you Jew SOB, you lousy mother effer, go home." The anti-war delegates lost every battle. A last-minute attempt to draft Edward Kennedy was aborted, and Humphrey won the nomination on the first ballot, with some 1,700 delegates, 847 more than the rest of the field. The convention left the party fractured. McCarthy refused to endorse Humphrey, who began the fall campaign far behind in the polls. "Right now you're dead," his campaign manager, Lawrence O'Brien, told him. He did come back and nearly made up the difference. At the end of September, he at last broke with Johnson and announced that he would halt the bombing. At the end of October, McCarthy finally endorsed Humphrey. It was not quite enough. On November 5th, something happened that would have been unthinkable a few years earlier. Richard Nixon was elected president. The story of this election has been told in many books, from Theodore H. White's The Making of the President 1968, and Lewis Chester, Godfrey Hodgson's, and Bruce Page's Mammoth and American Melodrama, both published in 1969, to Michael A. Cohen's American Maelstrom, which came out in 2016. It is featured in classic histories of the post-war period, including Hodgson's America in Our Time, Alan J. Matusow's The Unraveling of America, G. Calvin McKenzie and Robert Reichsbrot's The Liberal Hour, and Todd Gitlin's The 60s. The story of 1968 presidential election is like oral poetry, a saga passed down from bard to bard that no one, or no one of certain age maybe, seems to tire of hearing. Lawrence O'Donnell's Playing with Fire, the 1968 election and the transformation of American politics, is the latest in the string of recitations. O'Donnell is the host of The Last Word on MSNBC. He has worked on Capitol Hill, and he was a writer and producer for The West Wing. His book relies almost entirely on published sources, and so it adds little to what we know. But he is a talented storyteller, and his analysis of campaign tactics is sharp. And the story of that election still matters. In 1968, Americans elected a man with some savvy and no principles. In 2016, they elected a man with neither. O'Donnell's book makes it a little easier to understand how we got from there to here. It turns out that the distance is not all that great. Americans tend to overread presidential elections. It's not that the results aren't consequential. It matters which party and which person and which party is in the White House. The mistake is to interpret the election as an index of public opinion. It sells something of a platonic abstraction. In close elections, such as those of 1960, 1968, and 1976, the vote is essentially the equivalent of flipping a coin. If the voting had happened a week earlier, or a week later, or on a rainy day, the outcome might have been reversed. But we interpret the result as though it reflected the national intention, a collective decision by the people to rally behind R and repudiate D. Even when the winner receives fewer votes than the loser, as in 2000 and 2016, we talk about the national mood and direction almost entirely in terms of the winning candidate, and as though the person more voters preferred had vanished, his or her position's barely worth reporting on. Millions more Americans voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 and for Hillary Clinton in 2016, then voted for Donald Trump. But the Trump voter is now the protagonist of the national narrative. People talk about how Americans want to roll back globalization, even though most Americans who voted appear to not want such a thing. The United States is one of the few democracies that does not have a coalition government, and a winner-take-all electoral system breeds a winner-take-all punditry. The winner-take-all interpretation of the 1968 election was that, with the defeat of Hubert Humphrey, the nation repudiated liberalism. The election supposedly marked the demise of an ideological consensus that had dominated national politics since Franklin Roosevelt's election in 1932, and that had made politically possible the use of government programs to remedy the inequities of free market capitalism. But did Humphrey lose because he was a liberal or because he ran a tone-deaf campaign? Here we are, the way politics ought to be in America, the politics of happiness, the politics of purpose, and the politics of joy, he chirped in a speech in which he announced his candidacy. The date was April 27, 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated 3 weeks before. It was a bizarre moment to introduce a phrase like the politics of joy. And although Johnson had been forced to withdraw from the race by two candidates who opposed his Vietnam policy, Humphrey did not mention Vietnam in the speech. Even after he had the nomination in hand, he seemed reluctant to dissociate himself from a policy with which the electorate had clearly lost patience. Yet the popular vote was surprisingly close. The margin was 800,000 votes, 0.7% of the total. Some of the Democratic base did not turn out, and some Democrats, my mother was one, voted but did not check a box for president. Another symbolic protest performed for a local audience. Humphrey got 12 million fewer voters than Johnson did in 1964, and he still nearly won a plurality. It's hard to believe that 12 million people consciously embraced liberalism in 1964 and consciously rejected it only 4 years later. O'Donnell argues that the lesson of 1968 is that, quote, the peace movement won, end quote. And although McCarthy is not an entirely sympathetic figure, he relies considerably on Dominic Sandbrook's 2004 biography, in which McCarthy comes off as sour and aloof. He is the hero of O'Donnell's story. The last word about Gene McCarthy, he says, should always be that no one did more to stop the killing in Vietnam than Senator Eugene McCarthy, O'Donnell says. This seems a stretch for any number of reasons, the most obviously being that McCarthy lost and that the war continued for 7 more years. Nixon didn't want to be the president who lost Southeast Asia to communism any more than Johnson did. And he had no idea how to end the war either. More than a third of all the Americans killed in Vietnam were killed during his presidency. It wasn't as though Nixon was winding things down. In 1970, he extended the war into Cambodia. In the last of the major campus disruptions, protesting students were killed at Kent State in Ohio and at Jackson State College in Mississippi. In 1972, after running again on a promise to end the war, Nixon ordered the so-called Christmas bombing of North Vietnam. In the course of 12 days, some 740 sorties by B-52s dropped 20,000 tons of bombs. 1,600 Vietnamese were estimated to have been killed. The purpose of the Christmas bombings was to pressure North Vietnam to negotiate an end to the fighting, which finally happened in 1973. But in 1975, the North Vietnamese marched into Saigon and united the country under communist rule, exactly the outcome that France and the United States had been fighting to prevent for 30 years. By then, Nixon had resigned and Gerald Ford was president. When O'Donnell writes that, quote, the peace movement drove U.S. forces out of Vietnam, not the North Vietnamese army, end quote, he is making the same mistake that every administration made, imagining that it was decisions taken by Americans that determined the fate of Vietnam. O'Donnell thinks that the nomination of Nixon marked the end of liberalism, at least in the Republican Party. Well, that's quite right. A certain type of Republican politician, the type represented by Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, who ran a poorly mounted and hopelessly belated campaign against Nixon, George Romney, the governor of Michigan, who knocked himself out of the Republican primaries early by telling a reporter that he had been, quote, brainwashed about Vietnam. And John Lindsay, the mayor of New York, who some foolishly hoped might be Nixon's vice presidential pick. They all largely disappeared from the party after 1968. But that leaves a question. Why didn't their supporters become Democrats? This is where the diagnosis becomes complicated. People who write and argue about politics are ideologues. They hold a coherent set of positions that they identify as liberal or conservative, or some variant like libertarian or leftist. But to millions of voters, those terms mean almost nothing. These voters do not think in ideological terms, and their positions on the issues are often inconsistent and lacking in coherence. Given the option, they will sometimes identify as moderates or centrists, but this tells us very little about how they will vote. The fact that voters are often responding to non-ideological clues helps to explain the apparent volatility of the electorate from race to race. In 1964, for example, running against Goldwater, a conservative from Arizona, Johnson carried the neighboring state of California with 59% of the vote. Only 2 years later, running as a conservative who had prominently backed Goldwater in 1964, Ronald Reagan was elected governor in California with almost 58% of the vote. In the 1968 presidential election, 40% of the people who had voted for Johnson in 1964 voted for Nixon, even though Nixon's opponent was Johnson's own vice president. What cues were those voters responding to? After Nixon's victory, two books, both of which became enormously influential, proposed explanations. According to The Real Majority by Richard Scammon and Ben Wattenberg, the 1968 election proved that, particularly in a time of extremes like the late 1960s, centrism was the winning position. Nixon got to the center, while Humphrey and the Democrats remained associated with the extremes. Centrism requires a delicate balancing act, which Nixon, a man with many innate liabilities as a politician, turned out to be extremely good at. He opposed the Johnson-Humphrey administration's policy on the war, but he had no policy of his own. Nixon never made the claim, often attributed to him, that he had, quote, a secret plan to end the war, end quote. That phrase was invented by a reporter. As long as the war was going badly, people who favored withdrawal and people who favored escalation both found in Nixon a congenial alternative. At the same time, Nixon figured out a position to run on. He became the candidate of, quote, law and order. Goldwater had used that expression in 1964, and so had Reagan in 1966. It was a brilliant political slogan, a whistle heard by many dogs. It transposed political issues like civil rights and Vietnam into what appeared to be a straightforward legal position. Crime is wrong, and criminals should be punished. To liberals who believed in the righteousness of the civil rights demonstrations and the anti-war protests, the disruption and violence that accompanied them was caused by the overreaction of the authorities. For most voters, though, the disruption and violence were the fault of the demonstrators. Most people don't like righteousness in others. They can be quite righteous about it. For these voters, it was not a contradiction to profess support for racial equality and to condemn the marchers in Birmingham and Selma, or to be against the war in Vietnam and to believe that people like Tom Hayden and Abby Hoffman should be locked up. In polls taken in 1968, only 3% of voters who objected to Johnson's policy in Vietnam were also sympathetic to anti-war protesters. My parents were part of that 3%. Politically, the most important event in the United States in 1968 was therefore the assassination on April 4th of Martin Luther King. Riots broke out in more than 100 cities. 39 people died and 20,000 were arrested. More than 50,000 troops were deployed. Washington, D.C. became a war zone. In Newark, New Jersey, there were nearly 200 fires. Large numbers of white Americans did not interpret this disorder in terms of social justice. They interpreted it as a breakdown of civil society. The rioters were not black or white. They were arsonists and looters who happened to be black. Nixon showed that political advantage came from steering clear of the underlying issues. He gave people respectable reasons to vote for a candidate they favored for what they might have worried were not such respectable reasons. The second influential post-1968 book was Kevin Phillips, The Emerging Republican Majority, published in 1969. This is the book that popularized what became known as the Southern Strategy. Like Scammon and Wattenberg, Phillips saw that millions of voters were repelled by what they regarded as extremism. But he gave a name to what he thought was the key issue. He called it, quote, the Negro problem, end quote. The big news electorally in 1964 was that a Republican carried five Southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and South Carolina. It was the first time those states had not gone Democratic since Reconstruction, and the reason was not obscure. The voting was white backlash against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which Senator Goldwater had voted against. Goldwater was not a segregationist. He was a states' rights conservative, but he flipped the South to the Republican Party. The key to exploiting this shift in party alignment, as Nixon understood, was not to oppose the civil rights movement, but to force the Democratic Party to take ownership of it. The Kennedys had seen the perils in that, and they had been extremely careful about not appearing to be too close to King. But Johnson effectively put his personal brand on the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and the party thus had to take on the baggage of the urban rioting and the militancy of groups like the Black Panthers. Republicans didn't have to say a word against integration. All they had to do was talk about law and order. Still, Nixon didn't carry the Deep South in the general election. George Wallace did. And Wallace didn't use a dog whistle. Wallace was the dog. He was elected governor of Alabama in 1962, a time when the official logo of the Alabama Democratic Party was a rooster with a banner above it reading, White Supremacy. The next summer, he achieved national recognition when he resisted the attempt to enroll the first black students at the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa. A year later, Wallace ran in the Democratic primaries and surprised many people by winning a third of the vote in Wisconsin and more than 40% in Maryland. In 1968, he ran as an independent, hoping to win enough electoral votes to deny any candidate a majority, giving himself leverage in choosing the next president. Wallace came to Massachusetts several times in the summer of 1968 on drives for signatures to get on the ballot. I heard him on one of those trips. The crowd was small and mostly hostile. What amazed me was that Wallace gave the stump speech he delivered everywhere, which consisted almost entirely of taunts, insults, and threats. He did not reason with his opponents. He called professors and Washington bureaucrats sissy britches and mocked the bearded professor who thinks he knows how to settle the Vietnam War when he hasn't got enough sense to park a bicycle straight. As president, he said he would seek indictments for any college professor who talks about hoping the Viet Cong win the war. He liked to invite hecklers to come up to the stage after his speech. "I'll autograph your sandals," he'd say. He told reporters, "I'd let the police run this country for a couple of years. I'm not talking about a police state, but sometimes it takes a police state to run some people." Voters did not need to be told who some people were. Wallace won just 3% of the vote in Massachusetts, but his act played well across much of the country, where he spoke to boisterously enthusiastic audiences. After a rally at Madison Square Garden, supporters marched out chanting white supremacy. People told reporters that they admired him because, quote, he says what he thinks. Late in the race, one of the reporters who covered Wallace, Douglas Kiker, tried to explain the phenomenon. It was as if somewhere, sometime, a while back, George Wallace had been awakened by a white, blinding vision. "They all hate black people, all of them," Kiker wrote in New York. They're all afraid, all of them. Great God, that's it. They're all Southern. The whole United States is Southern. Anyone who travels with Wallace these days on his presidential campaign finds it hard to resist arriving at that same conclusion, end quote. Wallace's big mistake late in the campaign was to name as his running mate a former general, Curtis LeMay, who advocated the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. LeMay terrified everyone, and Wallace ended up with 13% of the vote. He was also hurt, as Humphrey was hurt, by being seen constantly on television surrounded by angry protesters. Those were the scenes people were voting to get away from, but Wallace carried the southern states that Goldwater had won in 1964, and as everyone now recognizes, he offered a taste of demagoguery to come. Objects in the rearview mirror often are really closer than they appear. It's not that far from Wallace to Trump. The focus on presidential elections makes it hard to see that from one election to the next, pretty much the same people are voting, and most people do not change much over time. The presidency is a beach ball bouncing along the surface, the winner an artifact of the circumstance that there are usually only two candidates to choose from. Public opinion, or the forces that move it, runs below the surface and has a much slower tempo. White voters abandoned the Democrat Party. In 1968, Humphrey got 38% of the white vote. In 1972, George McGovern got 32%. In 1980, Jimmy Carter, a white Southerner, got 36%. In 2016, Hillary Clinton, running against the toxic nitwit who is now the face of our politics, received 37%. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen the next time I'm reading for the Triangle Radio Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, everybody. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer.